Thanks for listening to this podcast of Trending with Timory. If you haven't already subscribed, please catch us wherever you love to listen to your podcast, from the Relevant Radio app to Apple, YouTube, you name it, we are there. And if you listen on Apple Podcasts, please be sure to go and give us a 5-star review to help other people discover the podcast. Anything you share in terms of episodes, whether it's texting it to a friend, posting on social media, helps to build up the kingdom for God, to help confront the challenging issues we face as a culture, but with joy, with hope, and with an eternal perspective where our faith collides with everyday life, bringing eternal principles to help us live our life joyfully.
So,
what's trending?
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
I am broadcasting today live from our Chicago studios. I'm here with my baby girl and my husband, getting to be in person with our team here at Relevant Radio. Pray for us. Pray for our ministry. Coming up, I'm going to talk about merging love, family, motherhood, and economics. How do we make that work within our homes? We'll dive into balancing work, family time, and attention between the children and your spouse. And I'll also be joined in just a little bit by Dr. Patrick Lappert. He's a plastic and reconstructive surgeon, and he's going to give us his thoughts on the Biden administration recently endorsing sex changes and cross-sex hormones for children. For children, we've heard this is harmful practice. This is irreversible practice being done to prepubescent children. We're going to talk about the real hard facts and understand what's happening, and even understanding what exactly is a sex change, and is this something a life-altering surgery that should happen for children at such a young age? You're listening to Trending with Timory here on Relevant Radio. Joining me now is a good friend and mentor, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. She is the founder and president of the Ruth Institute and has written countless books, one of which is a book that came out some years ago called Love and Economics. It's actually the very first book that I read after finishing graduate school, and it really helped me to mold my trajectory in working in ministry professionally and into married life with a spouse and children. And in that book, Love and Economics, she fuses together the ideas of economics and family life and what's necessary to sustain that for excellent human beings and as a person of faith. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse holds a doctorate in economics. She was a committed career woman before having children. She taught 5 years at Yale and is currently, again, the founder and president of the Ruth Institute, found at theruthinstitute.org. Dr. Morse, your book, Love and Economics, will be one of those books for years to come that people will turn to really understand the inner workings of the family and how that impacts feminism and the work-life environment. Can you share with us about your own journey in both writing this book and as a PhD-holding professional and a mother?
Wow, Timory, what a great introduction. Thank you so much for all of that. I didn't realize this book had had such a big impact on you. I'm really pleased to hear that. So thank you for that. So I started writing this book. It's hard to say, you know, people ask you, how long did it take you to write that book? I don't know how long it took, but it came out in 2001. When I still had young children underfoot. And as you mentioned, I was a committed career woman, you know, taught economics at the university level. And the plan that I had for myself, Timory, is that I was going to wait until I got tenure, and then I would have the baby at the very beginning of the summer, and then take care of the baby during the summer and go back to work in September, right when school started. That was the plan I had for myself. And that's what all the women I knew, all the other female professors I knew, that's what they all did. But so imagine my surprise when the baby did not arrive during the month that I had set aside for it. And so that was really, oh, excuse me, I got a frog in my throat. That was the beginning of my conversion, my reversion, really, back to the Catholic faith, because that was the first time I couldn't get what I wanted by trying harder and working harder and, you know, and being the good, strict professional that I had become, you know. And so I really learned that I had to let go of controlling all the outcomes, and that led me back to the faith and so on. But what really did it, what really did the job, was the kids that we ended up having. We had a 4-year experience of infertility, my husband and me. Mm-hmm. And we ended up adopting a little boy from Romania in 1991. And we got a phone call from the orphan, not the orphanage, the adoption lady called us in January of 1991. And if you remember, think about your, you know, kind of current history, that was the very beginning of when kids from Eastern European orphanages were coming available. You know, that right. was kind of the first batch of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I went, we got the phone call saying, we got a little boy for you. He'll be 2.5 years old when you get, when he arrives. What do you say? And we said, sure, why not? Now, when you've been infertile for 4 years, you don't really believe that a baby's really going to come, you know, mm-hmm. so like, oh, sure, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then 10 days later, I went to the doctor with a head cold and found out that I was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah. 1991 was a big year at the Morse family. So,
two babies at once.
Well, we had two kids in 6 months, you know, yeah. and they were 3 years apart in chronological age. But developmentally, in many ways, they were, of course, much closer than that in age. And our little boy had been in a profoundly neglected kind of situation. And we came to learn a lot about infancy and attachment and all sorts of issues that people don't normally encounter in the usual ordinary course of parenting, you know. And what it taught us, Timmery, what it really showed us is that children actually really truly do need their parents mm-hmm. because you could see how much mothers and fathers are doing for their children when you see a child who didn't have any of it, you know, and where you're starting from nothing at the age of 2.5. Yeah, you know, I mean, he didn't know his name, if you can imagine.
Wow.
He didn't respond to his name or anything. Mm-hmm. So we started really coming to respect what it is that parents do. What moms do, what dads do, the different roles that they play, the way they have to support one another, you know. Mm-hmm. So the importance of the love between the mother and the father, how that's the foundation for the development of the child's whole personality, really. So that's how I got interested in the topic. And it never would have happened if my whole plan for myself had worked out, you know, obviously. God whacked me with a 2x4 here, you know, to get me shaped up a little bit. But that's what got me interested in these topics, Timmery. If it hadn't been for that, I would be a mediocre economic historian who is ready to retire now. and as it is, I'm just getting started. I'm just getting cranked up.
We're going to discuss in just a moment with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse from the Ruth Institute, balancing work, family, time, and attention between your children and your spouse. But before we do that, you know, it's fascinating looking back at having read your book, Love and Economics, and the roles that mothers and fathers play in their children's lives. And even your own story with your son, who came from a European orphanage, and the delays in development that he experienced
yes.
because of lack of physical touch and engagement. To follow that story and then to see what's happening parallel to the crisis of the developmental delays in children today as a result of COVID. And although many people yeah. have been home, many people have been very addicted in utilizing their phones, and it's led to a dumbing down, unfortunately, in the development of children today and lacking social skills. I have a friend, she just moved across country. She lived in Los Angeles, and her little boy was born during COVID, just like my baby girl. And she said when she moved out to Tennessee and all of a sudden she's there and there are no masks and her kids seeing other people, he's finally started talking now, and to see
wow.
that change has been magnificent.
Oh, wow.
But Dr. Morse, a yeah. lot of people don't realize what's happening with these developmental delays and the significance and how parents can help supplement that, not just in an era of COVID, but every single day, the need for parents and what they offer their children.
No question about it. And the face is really crucial to child development. And, you know, so I certainly hope that when families were home with newborn babies, that they were not masking themselves and their babies inside their own home. But mm-hmm. I'm sure some people did, you know, because people were so frightened, you know. It's hard to really remember that now. I feel I'm in Louisiana, and it hasn't been as crazy as some of the other places across the country, you know.
Right.
So we've been in better shape from that perspective for quite a while. But when you think about the early days of the pandemic, or the supposed pandemic, whatever you want to call it, in the early 2020, everyone was so frightened. And mm-hmm. so people were doing things that that they wouldn't have ordinarily done. And to put a mask on the mother, even if you don't mask the baby, right? The baby's looking at their mommy, right? And the baby is making connections with their mommy. The baby's recognizing the face, the facial expressions. It's literally true that the synapses of your brain are developing, you know, the connections in your brain are developing when you are in your mother's arms, being rocked, looking at her. Because the baby's brain isn't fully developed. If a child's brain were fully developed before birth, the head would be too big to make it down the birth canal. So something has to happen after birth, you know, to finish human development. Mm-hmm. And in God's providence and beauty, the thing that develops after birth is your ability to be social. Mm-hmm. That's the part of the brain, the limbic brain, which I didn't know when I wrote Love and Economics, Timmery. I only learned that in the subsequent few years. My second book has a discussion of the limbic brain in it. That second book is called Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. But the limbic brain is the part of the brain that governs your ability to be in relationship with others. It's the part of the brain that recognizes moods and facial expressions and that feels something when you're in the room and everybody else is excited. You can sort of intuit that something big's going on, that kind of thing. That part of the brain develops in your mother's arms while you're looking at her, mm-hmm. right? So to mask a mother while she's interacting with her infant, we have literally no idea what we just did,
right.
But it can't possibly be good. It cannot possibly be harmless,
right.
You know? And so what I like what you said about it, Timmy, because what people are doing in their own homes is really important. If the family's under stress and you put a lot of extra stress on the family, which of course we know COVID did for a lot of people, then that's going to really be a challenge for the kids. On the other hand, if the mm-hmm. parents are not working anymore and the kids aren't in school anymore and you're together more and you have the kind of emotional resources to deal with that, well, then that can be a really good thing, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
For some people, I imagine that's the case, right?
Right.
But for others, I'm sure it was really very difficult.
I'd like to speak briefly, and if you're just joining us, you're listening to Trending with Timmery here on Relevant Radio. That's at Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. I highly recommend her work, her books at the Ruth Institute. You can find her at ruthinstitute.org. That's ruthinstitute.org. We'll include a link in the podcast notes as well as on Twitter. We'll post that link now on Twitter. You can follow me at Timmery, T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E, as well as her book, Love and Economics. Please be sure to check it out. But in your book, you talk a lot about two ideas, the idea of understanding the impact of daycare and the separation between the mother and the child, and also as a remedy, really upholding the God-given vision of the family and the human person. The premise is that the father takes care of the mother takes care of the baby, and that this is something we need to fight to uphold economically in our society. Can you speak to this?
Yes, I'd love to speak to that. You know, when I look back on it, when I wrote Love and Economics, I was concerned about too much daycare. You know, that was mm-hmm. something that I was concerned about, single parenthood, I was concerned about divorce, and I was concerned about too much daycare. Looking at where we are today, it's almost quaint that anyone would be worried about daycare when we have transgenderism, you know, which you mentioned in the tee up. Your next guest is, you know, is going to be dealing with. The ship has just continued to go further and further and further away from its home port, and so yeah, it's heartbreaking to me actually how things have gone. And I was writing this book to try to stem the libertarianism. I was really trying to talk to libertarians because that was my kind of my home base within economics, was the free market economics community, you know.
Right.
And everybody was all about individualism, and we were about individualism as a counter to collectivism and socialism,
right,
which needed to be countered, you know. I mean, there's mm-hmm. no, I don't regret that a moment, you know, that when that needed, something needed to be said about that. But what we didn't understand is that the market isn't the only institution that allows for cooperation, right? That's non-governmental and non-coercive in nature. The family is a social, truly social institution. We have to think in terms of social things, not just public versus private. That's the way we thought about it all the time in economics. You know, you got the private sector over here, you got the government over there, and that's just not the whole story, you know. So that's one of the things I was grappling with there in the book. And so my libertarian friends would all be about, oh, isn't daycare wonderful? It gives people what they want. It allows mothers to work more. And work is so productive and so wonderful and so great. And isn't it great that we have daycare? And that's true up to a point, right? But the point where it isn't so true is that not all children do well in daycare. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's some very predictable patterns about kids who don't do well in daycare. And as you may imagine, when we adopted our little boy from Romania, he didn't do well in daycare, Timmery. You know, you'll be shocked to learn, you know, that wasn't a great idea. Now, that didn't stop me from trying, you know, because I still had all this idea that I needed to work and so on and so forth. And by the way, let me say, my son is fine now. Our son has done fine. He's okay. The terrible things we were so frightened about, attachment disorder and all that. None of that happened, so he's fine. And so we can joke around about it a little bit in our family, you know, that he flunked daycare. and it's funny now in retrospect. But one of the things that you see with children with, you know, what's called non-maternal care or, you know, institutional care, is that little boys actually are more likely to do poorly in daycare. Because they need their mommies to regulate the world for them. They need the secure attachment with their mommy. Because boys, you know, they literally are more dependent on their mothers. Boys are, I actually recently read an actual statistic. Girls are about 4 to 6 weeks ahead developmentally at birth.
Wow.
Between boys and girls.
Fascinating.
And girls are more tuned into the social world and so on and so forth. And so the mother, the little boy, needs a sensitive caregiver to help him navigate the world and to mediate the world and so on. And so there's research on this, actually, Timmery. You know, if the mother's depressed, if the mother's disengaged in some way, you know, those things are more risky for the boy than they are for the girl. And that shows up, that same kind of pattern shows up in the daycare literature, which was a thing back in the 1990s. I don't know if anybody's even studying it anymore, to be honest. I haven't kept up with it. But in the 90s, when I was reading this literature, you know, what you'd see is, you know, the girls would come home from daycare with a bigger vocabulary, and the boys would be fighting and biting and, you know, flunking out of daycare. You know, I mean, they would get aggressive and they'd be upset and that kind of thing. So what I would always say, I learned to say to new parents, you know, is look, you cannot count on all of your children doing well in daycare. You don't really need to know about the studies. What you need to know is my child doing well in daycare? And if you plan your family and your budget around both parties working all the time, you're in a bind. Then, you know, you got to pay your mortgage, you got to keep working because, you know, you have all these bills that you bought into at the time that you were counting on everybody working full time. And now you got a kid who's not doing well in daycare. You're going to have to shuffle that deck for the benefit of that one child. And so I would just say to anybody, you can't count on all your kids doing well in daycare all the time. You don't care what the studies show. You care about your child.
Right.
And not all children do well in daycare, and you could get one of them, you know, and that's just the way it is.
And many people are finding themselves with a lack of freedom with it when it comes to how they would like to raise their family, that they're married to two incomes, they're married to a certain cost of living, type of living, and to scale that back is extremely difficult. And so these are conversations, Dr. Morse, that I wish people were having with teenage girls, with teenage boys, to help them start to plan, even when it comes to what sort of education you're going to have, what jobs you accept. I mean, I knew I wanted to be able to raise my own children and not send them to daycare, and that deterred me from accepting various positions in ministry and work that I knew would not be family friendly if and when the time came to have children. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is joining me now on Trending with Timmery here on Relevant Radio. You can find her at the ruthinstitute.org. That's ruthinstitute.org. We'll include links on social media. But I'd like to speak in these next few minutes about balancing work, family time, and attention between your children and spouse. This is something that you often speak to. It's a crisis that will continue to be a conversation debate among spouses as well as women, working moms versus stay-at-home moms. Can you give us some of your keen insights on what you've learned as a dedicated career woman turned a full-time mom and now having studied this for years?
Right, right. Well, you know, it's funny you bring this up because honestly, when I started the Ruth Institute in 2008, what I thought I was going to end up doing was talking to college girls about why it was okay to start their families, say, sometime before menopause. You know, that you don't have to put it off forever like I did, you know? You don't have to do it that way. And to plan for it and to, you know, we're so intentional about our education and our career. You got to think about your family too and that's important to you and finding a spouse and not taking on too much student debt. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. That's a bigger killer than a mortgage, honestly.
Right.
And it's more insidious because the people don't realize it until it's like way too late, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's another big conversation we need to have, But as far as the spousal relationship is concerned, I think I would say the biggest thing you have to watch out for, especially women, is we cannot neglect our husbands. You know, we have this bond with our little babies. The baby's needy. You could always justify more time with your baby, you know, but you cannot neglect your spouse. When the baby grows up and moves away from home, you're still going to be there with your spouse, you know. And so you've got to, for that reason, the kind of practical reason, but also because the love between the mother and father is really the foundation of the child's personality. Mm-hmm. And when you love each other and you put each other first, the child learns, number one, this home is secure. This is not going to blow up under my feet. Now, of course, children don't think that consciously, but you and I can think, well, what's the alternative to mom and dad not being stable? It's an explosion and a complete disruption of the child's little life. Of course, mm-hmm. you don't want that. But the other thing the child learns is that they're not the center of the universe. Dad and mom are the center of the universe to each other. You're like a little thing orbiting around the sun. You know, they're the sun. mom and dad are the, what do you call it, a double star or something like that. And the kids are orbiting around. And that's very important, I think, to help the child have a more mature understanding of their place in the universe. If we're hovering over them all the time, giving them what they want all the time, that's not realistic, right? And so when dad comes home and mom and dad embrace one another, and it's like, okay, kids, you just wait a second. Mom and dad are together. You'll be fine. Stop, you know. That conveys something very powerful to the children. And it also tells the kids, I can totally remember this, that when my husband would walk through the door, I would just breathe a sigh of relief that he was there. He didn't have to do anything. He didn't have to do a darn thing. You know, it's just, oh, he's there, you know.
Right.
And I'm sure a lot of moms feel that way, you know, that your backup team is here. That if there's been chaos in the household, the kids naturally quiet down, right? Dad walks through the door. He doesn't have to blast the world with his dad voice. It's just, oh, dad's home. I think fathers have the capacity to do that in a gentle way that is nonetheless authoritative. You know, there's a difference between being an authority figure and bossing people around, you know. And dads learn to do that, and it's a very powerful and beautiful thing.
That's Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse from the Ruth Institute. Find her at ruthinstitute.org. We've included links in the podcast notes. You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray. We'll be right back with Dr. Patrick Lapper, a plastic reconstructive surgeon, talking about sex changes being endorsed by the White House for minors, little kids. We'll be right back.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Complete your Lenten journey with Close to Jesus to the Last, a 5-day spiritual walkthrough of Jesus' final days before his passion. With Father Rocky's guidance, we'll pause for an hour at 11 a.m. and this hour, 6 p.m. Central, each day to ponder the events that drew Jesus to Jerusalem, exploring each with specially selected music and prayer. Close to Jesus to the Last, a reverent transition from Lent to Easter next week on Relevant Radio. You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray here on Relevant Radio. We've been walking through consecration to St. Joseph and some of the beautiful, keen insights of St. Joseph and his life. And momentarily, I just want to share today the meditation from consecration to St. Joseph by Father Calloway, focused on St. Joseph as the spouse of Mary. And how profound this is to understand he took Mary as his queen, as the delight of his heart in his daily living. And there's a quote in the book by Father Calloway that really stood out to me when talking about this relationship of how St. Joseph looked at the Blessed Virgin Mary in this complementarity of femininity and masculinity. I read, she was the only woman who could ever satisfy St. Joseph's chaste heart. As Adam was not fulfilled until he rested in a creature similar to himself, that is Eve, Joseph only found rest when he found Mary. When he took Mary's hand in marriage, he consecrated himself to her and made a promise to treasure her femininity. I think that speaks to helping us understand in an age of gender confusion, the power of femininity and masculinity, the gift, and even seeing from the dawn of creation that Adam was alone in that garden waiting for Eve, and St. Joseph too, waiting for the Blessed Virgin Mary for that complementarity between the two of them and that loving relationship of sacrificial love and total abandonment to the will of God that made them the parents of Jesus Christ. It's such a powerful moment to ponder St. Joseph as the spouse of Mary. Fantastic news on Oklahoma. The Oklahoma House has passed a bill similar to Texas in terms of how it will be implemented. Texas law, the pro-life law that bans abortion after a fetal heartbeat, is making it so that the prosecution, that is those who hold and regulate and hold people accountable to not perform abortions, are citizens just like you and I. Well, Oklahoma today passed a bill in the House. It already passed the Senate, similar to Texas. But in this case, the Oklahoma bill actually completely outlaws abortion in all cases. All cases except for there is an exception having to do with severe health concerns of the mother. But other than that, and again, that's still not acceptable. One day we will hopefully see that eliminated. But the Oklahoma House bill would essentially leave this act of performing an abortion a felony punishable up to 10 years in prison, up to $100,000 in fines. Listen to this. This was voted and passed by the House in a vote of 70 to 14. 70 people voting to end abortion in the state of Oklahoma. Praise God. This is something we will see continuing to happen state to state, either digging in with pro-abortion laws on the books or pro-life laws in the expectation of the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Supreme Court ruling coming this June of what the future of abortion will be potentially. And I really do hope and believe the overturning of Roe versus Wade, which would mean each state has to decide for itself what their abortion laws will or will not be. And so this is a reminder that we must stay involved in our local state and be prepared for abortion to be one of the greatest battles that we see to make various states pro-life states, as places such as my state, California. Today, they were voting on a law, potentially, to make it legal to kill your child 7 days after birth as a woman. And this is what we're up against. But in the meantime, we have fantastic news. Legislators and people grassroots helping to make this pro-life law pass. And the great news is that we see the governor Kevin Stitt, who is outspokenly pro-life, has said that he would sign any anti-abortion, any pro-life legislation that came across his desk. So with that in mind, we're looking at this becoming law in the state of Oklahoma this August, once signed by the governor. So praise God. It's a moment to celebrate. Let's really celebrate this victory, celebrate the lives that will be saved, and continue to advocate for life, because laws change and save lives. And individuals standing in front of the abortion clinic or whatever you're able to do change and save lives. You're listening to Trending with Tim Ray here on Relevant Radio. Last week, the news came out from the Biden administration endorsing for little children sex changes and hormone replacement therapy, so-called hormone replacement therapy. We know that cross-sex hormones, we've talked about it before here on Trending, given to a child prepubescently, blocks puberty, the natural development and progression of the human person. We know countless studies have shown that 9 out of 10 children who struggle with gender dysphoria, that they will work it out for themselves, choosing and accepting their biological sex if there's no intervention, if there's no ushering them into the transgender movement and ideology. And joining me now to really touch on the impact of sex changes, so-called gender affirmation surgeries, is Dr. Patrick Lapper. He's a plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He's been with us here on Trending before. He's also a deacon in the Catholic Church. And Dr. Lapper, I'd like to hear your initial reaction to the Biden administration endorsing sex changes, top and bottom surgery for little children.
Hello, Timory. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, it kind of is not a surprise to me that the Biden administration has gone down this road. If you'll recall, one of the very first things that the Biden administration did was make a very public announcement about a relatively minor figure in the Health and Human Services Department as being a transgender person who's right now, of course, all over the news. But to make such an appointment, such an important part of moving into the White House, it speaks volumes as to who's guiding this administration. Now, I wouldn't lay this at the feet of President Biden, because I really doubt that he's making these decisions. But there's a great deal of healthcare money involved in this whole transgender movement. And we know, as you pointed out in your introduction to this segment, that children who are not encouraged into this gender ideology, children who are allowed to grow up as children ought to grow up and who have the support of their families, and perhaps children who may get a little therapeutic intervention and maybe some family therapy, over 90% of them will get over it by the time they move into young adulthood. But if you take those same children and you bring them into the gender clinics, they're virtually guaranteed. It approximates 100% of them who are started on a gender affirmation, social transitioning, will continue on to puberty blockade and cross-sex hormones. And by the time you've started them down that road, it's virtually guaranteed that they will come into adulthood with major, major changes to their bodies, to their personalities as a result of these horrible interventions. And what you have then is a lifelong dependent of the healthcare system, and massive amounts of money changes hands every time they get a child enrolled in this process. So massive healthcare dollars, big pharma, big surgery, big hospital systems, and it's being supported by some very strong and very well-funded political organizations. So
that's Dr. Patrick Lapper here on Trending with Tim Ray. He's a plastic and reconstructive surgeon. And I'd like to touch on, and I know this is a sensitive topic for a lot of people, the topic of gender dysphoria. Many of us have had loved ones who've experienced gender dysphoria, might be struggling with their identity, may know someone, and we want to have a compassionate response. We want to support and encourage people. But what the Biden administration is doing goes against any research and support the pro-gender ideology movement is trying to make claims academically in terms of research that are not held up. We do not have any clear research that, for example, a parent affirming a child in a opposite gender, that this actually helps a child with their mental health. There's no research that upholds it. Actually, quite the opposite. We have many studies, one as recent as 2016, another 2017 from Shum, Crawford, McLaughlin, Olson, various researchers affirming that parents do not improve the children's mental health when transitioning. But I want to talk about the sensitive topic, and for some, this is hard to hear. And a little warning, maybe this is something you return to later on the podcast, relevantradio.com/trending or wherever you catch your podcasts. I want to discuss Dr. Lapper. For those who don't understand What an actual sex change is and the difference between top and bottom surgery. If you could kind of help us in understanding the significance of it, the irreversibility, and the reality of what this means long term for an individual who goes through with this.
Okay, well, the place to begin is that there's no such thing as sex change. It's an impossibility. That terminology has been floating around for a long, long time, even since back in the early 20th century when the first surgeries were being performed. They would use that terminology, but it's scientifically quite inaccurate because you can't change somebody's sex. You can change their sex appearance by creating counterfeit structures and by destroying existing structures in an irreversible way. As you pointed out, there's the surgical interventions are divided into two major groups. There's what we call top surgery, and this includes a whole host of what I would characterize as minor procedures, everything from hair transplants to tracheal shaving and things like that to give the face a more masculine or feminine appearance. Rhinoplasty, surgery on the nose, surgery on the brow, things to feminize a face or to masculinize a face. That's in the category of top surgery. And those, for the most part, are, in a sense, reversible. On the other hand, top surgery also includes breast surgery, which the largest, newest demographic in transgender is the adolescent female who identifies as a male.
Right.
And when you're talking about top surgery in that demographic group, you're talking about irreversible mastectomy and what they call chest masculinization surgery. And, you know, people are being misled even by, well, especially by the proponents of transgender medicine and surgery. They're being misled into believing that, well, that's reversible too. That is not reversible. All you can do if a young woman changes her mind is you can give her the appearance of breast mounds, as we do for a woman who's had mastectomy for cancer. But she doesn't have breasts. She has breast-like mounds, but she'll never be able to breastfeed, and neither will she have normal sensation from the nipple, because chest masculinization surgery permanently severs the nerve connection between the nipple and the hypothalamus of the brain, which is where the oxytocin release happens and all of the what we call erotogenic sensibility from the
during
nipple.
Intimacy.
That is not recoverable. That will never come back. So so essentially you have a numb chest and the destruction of the human faculty of breastfeeding, which is irreversible. And then you move on to the bottom surgery, as it's euphemistically called. And this is the irreversible genital surgery, where essentially the person is castrated. Their native external genitalia are mutilated. Sometimes, for example, in the male who seeks to present as a female, his native genitalia are used as tissue to create a counterfeit vagina, which of course is not an actual reproductive structure, it's just a counterfeit. And the female seeking to present as a male will have her form of castration is oophorectomy and vaginectomy and hysterectomy, and then the creation of a counterfeit phallus or something
and
like
just
that.
Just to interrupt you briefly for a moment, I know some people who are listening, we're talking about with Dr. Patrick Lappert. He's a plastic reconstructive surgeon, as well as a deacon in the Catholic Church, and he's been at the forefront of helping us to understand the reality of so-called gender affirmation surgery, what people are calling sex changes, emphasizing that there's no such thing as a sex change. There's an appearance of seemingly looking as if you were the opposite sex, but you can't actually change your sex. And he's helping us to understand what the reality of top and bottom surgery are and the manipulation of the body to create an appearance that President Biden and his administration, the LGBTQ movement, are trying to push forward as a so-called means of bringing happiness and mental health to individuals, which no research actually supports this. But it's important we understand what we're discussing with regard to so-called sex changes. You can't change your sex. Dr. Lappert, as you're talking about the castration of the native genitalia and what's actually happening, can you continue to help us understand what this is?
Well, so in essence, what is done, for example, in a female seeking to present as a male, is that she has removal of all her internal reproductive structures, which makes her a lifelong dependent on the medical system for hormonal support. And then when she's taking high doses of male hormones in an effort to masculinize her body, it will have effects on her one of her native structures, the clitoris, which will become hypertrophic or overgrown, as it were. One of the common operations done to persons seeking to present as males is what's called a metoidoplasty, where that hypertrophic clitoris is surgically modified so that the urethra is lengthened at the base of that structure so that the person can urinate standing up, which is one of the commonly stated goals of women who seek to present as men, the ability to walk into a men's room and urinate standing up. So that's called a metoidoplasty. It's one of the most commonly performed genital operations in what are called female to male gender affirmation operations. The more aggressive operation is the creation of what's called a neophallus, where an entire structure is created out of tissue borrowed from elsewhere on the woman's body to create a phallus that has within it a skin-lined urethra tube. And that's transplanted like as a free flap to the area of the groin to create a counterfeit phallus, which has, of course, none of the attributes of native genitalia, but it just appears like a phallus through which the person can urinate. These are subject to frequent complications, strictures of the neo-urethra, leakages of the neo-urethra, extrusion of implanted devices that are placed in there to give the person the capacity for penetrative intercourse, infectious complications, urinary obstruction,
right.
All kinds of problems that are never spoken about in public because that's sort of the modus operandi of the surgical community that does these things.
The reality.
They give the public the impression that we're capable of producing, you know, totally normal-looking genitalia, but we're not.
It's a hidden secret. Yeah,
it's a hidden secret. But if you look into the complication rate for these operations, and I've had to do that because I do expert testimony on this matter, the complication rate, depending on the particular operation chosen, is fairly high. And what you're looking at, of course, is a lifelong problem now of managing the urinary tract, of managing implanted devices, of managing the counterfeit structure.
That's Dr. Patrick Lappert here on Trending with Tim. We're going to come back discussing with him the God-given plan and vision of the human person, the body, as a plastic reconstructive surgeon and a deacon in the Catholic Church. He's helping us to understand how we must handle this crisis of so-called sex changes being endorsed by the highest levels of this current administration in the United States. We'll be right back here on Trending.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Joining me now is Dr. Patrick Lappert. He's a plastic and reconstructive surgeon. He gives his expert testimony even before the political powers that be today as we confront this crisis surrounding an ideology of gender dysphoria that is damaging. There is no research that supports the claim such as that a so-called sex change, you can't change your sex, that a so-called sex change improves mental health, nor that it reduces suicide. There is no research that supports it. The LGBTQ community is falsely making this claim. And this is one of those moments as people of faith, as people who can use our capacity to reason, this is a part of being a human person, we have to dissect what we are hearing, even when the highest levels of administrations in the United States or political bodies or medical bodies claim otherwise. And so Dr. Patrick Lappert is here to help us understand the truth and the reality of what so-called sex change is, the reality that, as you mentioned a moment ago, Dr. Lappert, that with the trend predominantly of girls wanting to be boys, that we're talking about the complete removal of the reproductive system, never being able to regain the capacity to reproduce. And you talk about a 13 or 9-year-old or 15-year-old girl today who's coming out and taking cross-sex hormones and then is going through with top and bottom surgery. She will never have children. And our president of the United States is endorsing this type of permanent mutilation of the body. Not only that, but recommending what is essentially, no one talks about this, but you mentioned it, she will have to be on cross-sex hormones for her life because her reproductive system has been damaged and removed. And so as you share the reality of top and bottom surgery, and if you're just joining us, it's graphic. It's hard to hear. It reminds me of when the pro-life movement first started to describe what abortion is. And people, even who are pro-life, didn't want to hear it. But we need to understand what we are fighting against. And so if you missed that conversation, I hope you'll go back, relevantradio.com/trending, and subscribe and listen to this podcast. But Dr. Lapper, as a plastic and reconstructive surgeon and a deacon in the Catholic Church, you really draw together how God got it right when he made a plan for the human person and our bodies and the complementarity. Can you speak as a plastic surgeon and a deacon, how you've seen the fusion and the function of the body, and even when there's confusion with so-called gender, the gift and the longevity of staying in your body as a good thing that actually helps us long-term?
Well, right. So this has been at the heart of our understanding of the nature of the human person, just for the longest time now. It's fundamental to our Catholic understanding of what it means to be a human person, that we have a single nature, that we are body and soul together comprising a single nature. It's not that we have a soul nature, that it's a body that carries a soul around, which is one of the great errors of this whole transgender mentality. And it, in fact, is quite diabolical. It's a diabolical mistake. We are body and soul comprising a single nature. And that's at the heart of the mistake of transgenderism, is because it divorces the person. It divides the person and causes people to think of themselves as being fundamentally a spirit creature that possesses a body, which is a heretical thing. And it's contrary to, the revealed truth of the human person. And so people speak these days about their bodies as being something they possess over which they can exercise dominion. And that is, if you believe that, then the incarnation of Jesus Christ makes absolutely no sense. And his atoning work on the cross is no longer efficacious. Because if you can divide the person that way, then the one who hung on the cross was not really a human being. He was just God appearing to be a human being, and therefore nothing was affected on the cross for our salvation. So this is not a small peripheral issue. This is at the heart of the war, the spiritual warfare that humanity is subject to right now. And to delude children into believing that transgenderism is a reality is a horrible thing. It's a heretical thing because it goes contrary to who we know that Jesus Christ is and he revealed to us who we are. So at the heart of the whole transgender idea is the idea that body and soul are somehow separate and still human. And that's not the case. That's not the case. We are body and soul together comprising a single nature. And that's really what's at the heart, from the Catholic perspective, that's what's at the heart of this thing. And it's such a horrific crime against humanity to get people, particularly children, believing that somehow they're in the wrong body, as if that's even a possibility, as if their body is something separate from their personal identity or their self. So it's a terrible heretical lie that the whole world is being subjected to now. And in particular, children are vulnerable to this kind of thinking. And so when a child is suffering, and they're offered this explanation, they'll jump on it. They'll jump on it, believing that if they go down that road of transgender self-identification, that somehow they're going to find happiness on the other side. Well, the fact is that the whole idea is contrary to human nature, because human nature, it's a single nature, body and soul together, comprising one nature, one identity. So,
and the culture ultimately is trying to be compassionate, where we're trying to offer a solution or help or aid to someone who is suffering. But a culture of compassion doesn't mean endorsing LGBTQ ideology, cross-sex hormones, or a so-called sex change. You can't change your sex. So what we believe what we know about the truth of male and femaleness, we need to tell the truth. And we need to help people understand that the pursuit of who you are as a woman and who you are as a man will make you happy. That's Dr. Patrick Lappert here on Trending with Timmery. I'll be back tomorrow here on Trending.
Trending with Timmery, bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life.
St. Irenaeus talks about how the life of man is a vision of God. The vision of God is something that we don't often ponder. The vision of God, God created us in his image and likeness. And if the vision of God is a man, well, how are we called to act? How are we called to interact? What are the virtues?
Trending with Timmery, live Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern on the Relevant Radio app or at relevantradio.com.